So it's also on our song sheet, but I don't know, do many people know the song, I Bring Light Into the Darkness? No? Would it be helpful to have the sheets? So if we don't have enough, we may need to share. Maybe one for two people. So I'll sing a line and you can repeat. I bring light into the darkness.
I bring light into the darkness.
I bring love instead of hate and fear.
I bring love instead of hate and fear.
I bring light into the darkness.
I bring light into the darkness.
I am always here within you.
I am always here within you.
You try that whole part? I bring light into the darkness.
I bring love instead of hate and fear. I bring light into the darkness. I am always here within you.
I bring the light and I bring the love.
I bring the light and I bring the love.
And I thank you. Bring the light
and I bring the light.
Remember, I am always here within you.
Remember, I am always here within you.
So from I bring the light, 2, 3.
I bring the light and I bring the love and I bring the light.
Remember, I am always here within you. So we try everything all together.
I bring light into the darkness. I bring love instead of hate and fear. I bring light into the darkness. I am always here within you.
Try it once more a little higher, and then we'll try breaking into two groups because it's beautiful as a round. So
I bring light into the darkness. I bring love instead of hate and fear. I bring light into the darkness. I am always here within.
Much higher, did I? Was that too low?
Yes.
It was like, so we'll try a little higher. But I think we can already be in two groups. If
the low voices could be in.
Oh,
so, all the way
yeah. Oh, that's something. We could have one group just sing the second part over and over.
Just do two parts.
Mm. Okay, let me try that. But we still need to start higher, I think. I think so. I bring light. Well, let's just try both groups singing both. So from Sheila and Anne this way, and okay, so we'll start, and then you come in at the halfway singing the first part. Okay, what's the note again?
I bring light into the darkness. I bring love instead of hate and fear. I bring light into the darkness. I am always here within you.
Questions here than we can answer. And I think, do you want to begin? You have one addressed directly to you. So.
And I think we also want to give space if people want to ask a question directly. So maybe we'll each answer a written question and then see if anybody has a question they want to ask. So there's one that says, concerns are often raised in our Sangha about educational activities and ecumenical nonviolent actions that try to decrease the suffering on the socio-political level. Some members worry that it will lead to dispersion and weakening of mindfulness practice and the Sangha. How can this be avoided? I think whatever activities that we would do as a Sangha, they would be an expression of mindfulness practice. So it wouldn't be that we do some activist or some kind of social action and that it wouldn't be mindful. This to me, then there's no point in doing it. It won't help. So if we see it as the practice, then I don't think it's any threat or challenge or disruption of our practice or of the Sangha. So I think the question more than what should we do is how do we do it? That's the most important thing. So I think we need to have a good foundation of harmony with each other. That doesn't mean we need to agree with everything, but we have to have a basic understanding that we want to go in the same direction and that we trust each other as fellow practitioners and that we open our hearts to each other to learn and to grow together. So there has to be a solid foundation in our relationships in the Sangha of a brotherhood and sisterhood. Or as I read recently, a brother in Deer Park to transcend any gender language, he called it Sanghahood. So we want really for there to be Sanghahood. And then anything that comes out of that will be beneficial. If the Sangha is in harmony, if there's real love between the members of the Sangha, that's already a contribution to the world. And then whatever actions we might decide to take together will be an expression of that. When we chant the three refuges, I take refuge in the Sangha, the community that lives in harmony and awareness. So that's the meaning of Sangha. That we're always practicing to be in harmony and to live with awareness together. Just an example of a Sangha that's taken a kind of action that is very much based in, grounded in the practice. You all might have heard already of the Washington, D.C. Sangha that organized walking meditations on Capitol Hill every month, inviting politicians to join and just walk mindfully on Capitol Hill to give politicians support in what they were doing through mindfulness. There were also young people in Germany together with Sister Annabelle from the European Institute of Applied Buddhism. She's the most senior sister in our community, along with Sister Cheng Kong. They were the first monastics ordained by Thay. She led, she participated in a protest of a slaughterhouse in Germany. I'm not sure if it was a walk or I don't know the details, but there are lots of actions that sanghas around the world are taking already. A lot of wake-up groups organize flash mob meditations in public places like a train station or a public park, or they'll just 30 young people doing quiet meditation for half an hour in like the Amsterdam train station, the main central station. And people will be really moved by that. They'll walk by, they'll see that, they might join, or a walking meditation. You know, people are impacted by that kind of message, a peace walk. So I think whatever we do as a Sangha, it should be an expression of the practice. We don't see it as, this is some activism that's outside the realm of the practice. And that we do it from a place of harmony and joy, you know. I think these things should bring us joy. We don't want to, you know, be burned out by this kind of activity. It should nourish us. We can sing, we can be open to learn and grow in that activity.
I think there was another question here that I don't have my glasses, so, but I think it's asking a very similar question.
Should I just read it out?
Yeah.
So the question is, please talk about balancing the process of education about the suffering of other beings and the specific impacts of global warming. For example, looking at seeing suffering with an open heart and mind, and so balancing that with taking care of ourselves to be able to act to alleviate the suffering and destruction of our planet.
So both of these questions deal with social activism or responding to suffering in the world. Individually and as a Sangha. You know, there's a mystic tradition of responding to the world of us and them, right and wrong, and from a place that holds it all. And I think what Sister Jewel just spoke about is a way of being able to respond to the suffering in the world that holds it, not as something separate, but as a way to illuminate and without condemning, without separating, without creating more suffering. When we did Touching the Earth last night, Intai spoke so much in all of those touchings about how we are all living in the same field of consciousness. We are all the same. Everything is a field of consciousness. And nothing is separate from that field of consciousness. And out of that field, everything arises. You arise, I arise. Sanghas arise, trees arise, planets arise. And each manifestation is unique and special and wonderful and a miracle. and each manifestation has its own expression in the world. So how you respond in the world of suffering will be particular to you, and how I respond will be particular to me, you know, through the gifts of this arising. And both are equally an expression of the Buddha mind, or the field of consciousness, or God, whatever term you would like to use. So I think that trouble arises in the Sangha when some people think, well, we need to do this. And other people think we need to do that. And when a Sangha can really move in the direction of all agreeing on a particular way of responding to the suffering in the world, then it's very powerful, very strong. I know the original beginnings of the Three Treasure Sangha, the Sangha that shares Dharma Gate with us in Seattle, was a Catholic worker group, and their action as a community was a soup kitchen specifically for women and children and families, because women and children who were homeless didn't feel safe going into most of the soup kitchens, which were largely represented homeless men. So it was called the Family Kitchen. And the Family Kitchen, you know, existed for years and years and years, and it was the outpouring of that Sangha, the support of that Sangha. There were people that did the gleaning, which would go to various bakeries, various stores. I know people here have participated in this, and get offerings from those, you know, leftovers, and go back to St. James and put, based on whatever they gleaned, put together a fabulous meal that would feed 200 people each day, every day. And, you know, that's an incredible outpouring of that Sangha that went on for years and years. Really blessed. And I think when a Sangha can move together in that way, or as Sister Jewel said, can really all agree to do walking meditation together. I think, you know, one of the dangers is that, you know, we tend to identify as self, and so everybody wants to do their own thing. And when we get caught in that, then it's much harder to move together as a Sangha. And I think probably lay practice tends to, I mean, just because we live making all our own individual decisions all the time, which is wonderful, it's sometimes harder to come together as a group and say, you know, as a group, we can do this together. So what I tend to see happening in lay sanghas, which I think is wonderful and I support wholeheartedly, is individuals have their work they do. And, you know, one of the really wonderful things about our sanghas is that almost everybody is doing something. It's just wonderful. And it's their own unique expression of their heartfelt desire of helping in the world. And they come, and as a result, because people are so devoted to helping in the world of suffering, they often, when we come together as Sangha, the important thing is to come together to practice and renew and restore ourselves, so we do have the energy to go out again into the world and you know, as a bodhisattva, not turn our backs in the face of suffering. And that is enough too. I know that that's been a debate that I've heard in a lot of different sanghas. You know, it's like, when I come to sangha, I want the support of sangha to practice. to renew my energy and restore myself. And then other people want to do something as an action within the Sangha. And because we tend to be so very, very busy in our lives, it's often really hard for us all to come together. And so even that can be a source of dissension, like the people who want to come to Sangha and say, oh, I just want to rest and restore myself. And the people who say, we need to be doing something in the, as a group in the world. I don't know the answer to that, except that to honor everyone where they are and honor each and every person in the Sangha for the work they are doing in the world. And you know, every once in a while when we can really pull together and make something happen, then that's really wonderful. It's really, and I think it does increase the strength of our Sangha to be able to move together like that. And it also, you know, is a statement of our practice to be able to do that. I just think that it's really important that we don't use social activism as a wedge for and against each other, for and against the world. That we don't use it as a way to divide ourselves into us and them in anything we do. And that means, you know, watching our minds really carefully. Because our thoughts are dualistic. Our thinking mind is dualistic, tends to be dualistic. And our practice is to look deeper than that. I actually just wanted to say one thing. There's a picture up in the cottage near where Sister Jewel is staying, that Aitken Roshi, who was always out protesting. And there's a picture of him holding a sign that says, "The system stinks." Every week. And you know, Coco Han, when we lived there, you know, we trained in civil disobedience, and you know, it's like this is very, did tax evasion, and just, it was very was a strong activist. And I think that, you know, really it's why Christ was crucified, right? It's why Christ was crucified. That when we see truly, we need to be able to stand in the world of oppression and injustice and suffering and point to it, but not as a way of condemning it.
To see if anyone would like to ask a question directly.
The difficulty I see, and I don't know the exact wording, but it does seem in a mindfulness training that the Buddhist teachings or the Sangha should not be used as a political instrument. And I think it would be very difficult to draw the line between what is a political statement and what isn't. My sort of thoughts are that maybe it's better that people do these things on an individual basis rather than as a group. But I would just like to hear what you have to say in relationship to that mindfulness training and the specific statement about using the Sangha for political purposes.
I think what Eileen spoke about and also what I was sharing about the way we do something, and that it's not coming from duality. I think to speak out against injustice, which is also in the 14 trainings, even if it puts us in difficulty or danger, to me that's different than taking a side. And, you know, when we... both the Democratic and Republican parties, and at least in the United States, I think they stand for pretty much the same thing. So to me, it's not that I'm on one side or the other. I mean, both, I think, are not helping very much in terms of what really needs to happen in the world. I mean, it's more like a let's keep our wealth. Let's keep doing, you know, try to keep doing what we're doing. Seems to be the... I know they fight a lot among each other, but I don't see that there's that much difference in their aims. So I think when we want to do something from a spiritual standpoint, to say, look, this is not going to work. And whatever angle we're taking, I don't see that as using the Sangha for a political purpose, because what is our goal? Our goal is to end suffering. We're not working with one party or another. Maybe we could say a lot of the concerns we've been talking about here and the things I see the Sangha engaged in, we could say those are in the progressive camp, at least on a political spectrum. But I don't see that aligned with the political party. And I think, like, when Thay did a retreat for Congress people, we tried to get anybody. Mm-hmm. We were happy if anybody from any political party would come. Of course, I don't think any Republicans came, but but we would have been happy to have them. You know, I mean, mindfulness for everyone. And same with, you know, when Thay addressed he gave a talk at the Library of Congress for Congress people and senators. So, I mean, it's like what we offer, we want to share with anybody who's open. And Eileen and I were discussing yesterday, like, making concrete plans how to put this Council of Elders together. And she was saying, we need people who are conservative, too, in this group. We need people who don't, you know, they shouldn't all be from the same kind of, they shouldn't all think alike. So I think that's the idea, is that, you know, inclusiveness and what's the motivation? If the motivation is coming from true deep looking into what we see as the suffering, I don't think we need to worry about using the Sangha as a political instrument.
This sort of brings up for me one of the other questions that was in the bell that I'd like to read. If we practice to save all beings, and all beings are already saved, why do we practice, and
why do we have precepts? Why have precepts? You know, we practice because we don't know all beings have been saved. Because we don't know that, we need to practice that, practice to uncover that. And when we uncover what is really there, then what we find is the heart of love. And that's the precepts right there. In our touching of the earth last night, Tai pointed to that over and over and over again. And then with the heart of love, we step forth in the world. In the world of this and that, anger and hatred, fear, we step forth without carrying any of that duality. And that's our practice. That's also our realization, both at the same time. You know, global warming is not, our climate chaos is not partisan. It's really, yeah, it's all of us. And I think that we've created climate chaos for us to realize something new. Something that's always been here. It's not something we're creating or discovering. It's always been here. And I like to think, you know, that you know, we're scaring ourselves to death so that we will at last answer for ourselves this question about birth and death. We read in the Middle Way, being is not being, non-being is not non-being. In touching the earth last night, over and over again, Tai was calling it Mother Earth, but pointing to something that is more essentially true about us than you and me, birth and death, good and bad. And when we uncover that truth of our existence, that there is no birth, there is no death, not as an idea, not as something conceptual, but as a real experience of the essential truth, the essential nature of the universe. Our fear of death leaves us and we stop projecting death onto the world. The world is a projection of mind. We can't comprehend this with our conceptual mind. This is beyond concept. But we can see it for ourselves because it is us. We've always been this. And it's not a raising of consciousness per se. It is, what is consciousness? And then, you know, as that, each of us respond to the world in our own unique way. In the world of this and that, which is not separate from the world of no this and that. The world of cause and effect is not separate from the world of no cause, no effect. They exist in the exact same moment. But in realizing that, then from that place we step forth as a free person. The last week we read Martin Luther King Jr. statement, loving your enemy. Very, very beautiful speech. All the reasons why, how important it is to love our enemies. And he was, that is the voice of all beings already saved. It is the voice of the precepts that he, in that speech. So there's a really lovely quote in Dogen where he says that, you know, when we have no awareness of ultimate reality, of ultimate truth, then we think all things are sufficient. You know, it's like everything in our life is, you know, we spend our time making everything in our life be the way we want it to be, and or making everything in the world the way we want it to be. You know, it's like if we can get everything straight. And then he goes on to say, but when we are aware, when we begin to touch that awareness of something bigger than us, that we're part of, then there's a sense of lack, of insufficiency. And that insufficiency is, you know, how can I help? My practice isn't enough. And out of that, you know, comes this really deep devotion to practicing for the sake of all beings. So that we don't understand the meaning of absolute nature is love, or absolute nature is no nature, self-nature is no nature, is good, is wonderful, that we don't understand that, to have that as the question. And it relates to another question here, is this little cunning mind holds on tight, bringing always all the afflictions imaginable. What can I do? What we can do is to have that deeper question, that it's not just about this distraction or this sense of despair or this moment of wonder or this flash of anger. That there's a deeper question that we're always asking and inquiring about. And that takes care of all sort of the little this and that, self and other, right and wrong. It doesn't negate them, but it allows us to look what's beneath them, always to be looking for what's beneath all my self-identification. And in that, we begin to touch what is really healing. And it might just be a moment of it. It might be a glimmer, a little opening. Some place of anger that we've been holding all of a sudden leaves us, and we feel totally forgiving of what the other person did, and able to hold them in love. That's like a glimmer of it. And we touch that at various points, you know, in our practice when, you know, something about self and other lets go, and we touch that heart. So it's really important to always know that when we do that practice that Thay taught us last night, that even though the words are cognitive, it's pointing to something that is real and whole, and from which everything arises, and we're not separate from that, you know. And you know, that is the, we can call it the mind of love, for illuminated nature, something essential nature. But because it's beyond concepts to put any kind of name on it at all, then obscures it, and we start looking for the wrong thing. And the only thing we can find is right here. and giving ourselves to this moment over and over again, whatever's arising, not turning our backs on any of it. So I think that that's, you know, where social action comes from. And that's when our social action can be a force of healing in the world, even though Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. He is still here with us and offering his healing vision. So is there another direct question?
In at least one place in the mindfulness trainings, we say, I know that I already have enough circumstances to be happy. And I can see that for myself. But what about a person who lives where there is war and famine, and who lives always in fear, and sees their children hungry, and has to spend all their energy of every day seeking survival and security? Can we ask them to make that statement? Is that fair or kind?
I guess I would come at it from the angle of we always have a choice of how we relate to what's happening, you know. We can make things worse or better in our own mind. Of course, you know, there are situations that we don't ever want to have happen to anybody, but they happen. You know, generation after generation, there is war, there is hunger, there is violence. And there is the practice all through those situations as well. I was looking at a book, I think it's called 6 Billion People, and it's this photographer who went all over the world taking people's pictures and asking them basic questions about what's happiness, what was your worst day, what is family, I mean, all the same questions, and just from all over the world. And there was one man who shared about his mother having survived Auschwitz as a Jew, and how she didn't pass any bitterness onto him. That she was determined to live a good life, and that he should live a good life, that all her children. And he was so uplifted through the way his mother had related to that situation. It was such a terrible situation, but she didn't lose her own faith in her own ability to be happy, her own right to live well. And we probably all know about Elie Wiesel, the Jewish writer who wrote as he was in the concentration camps, and um, that was his place of awakening. That was mud in which he grew his lotus of unbelievable humanity in the face of terrible, terrible inhumanity. So, I mean, we know that people like him are pretty rare, you know, but it does show us that even in, you know, the deepest hell realm that human beings create for each other, there is still a choice. There is still, we each have our own free will of how we relate to whatever inhumanity is shown to us. Does that mean we should still do everything we can to relieve people's suffering? Definitely. But still, it doesn't mean that people don't have their own choice, how they will confront that situation. And there's another story of a Tibetan monk who was tortured and held in prison for many years by the Chinese, and he was able to escape to India, and he met with the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama asked him, how was it for you? And the monk said, well, I was in great danger. And the Dalai Lama asked, danger of what? And the monk said, I was in danger to get angry. No. But he didn't. He was able to go through that very terrible experience and not see that the Chinese were his enemy. His torturers were his enemy, but to see that they were human beings who were acting out of ignorance and who were creating great suffering also for themselves.
So enlightenment isn't an individual matter, like Thay says that. And so we practice like our hair is on fire for people in Sudan and in Syria and China, Tibet. So it's not like we're doing this practice for ourselves at all. But we're doing it because everything we touch in the field of consciousness changes the whole, everything. And so we have to do that. And I think it's really especially important for lay people to remember that, because we get so distracted by our lives that we run off in this way and we run off in that way and we do this and we do that, and then somewhere we remember, oh yeah, I'm practicing. And then, you know, touching that deep, deep well of why we're practicing for the sake of all beings. Yeah, for the sake of the eagles and the salmon and the starving child. And, you know, all of that is a mystery, how we're all connected, but we are. And every speck of light that you touch affects the whole consciousness. and that is that perhaps an act of faith, but initially, but it becomes very real at some point, and it allows us then to trust whatever's happening, and even if we don't like it. Especially if we don't like it. Trust it and look into it. And in the looking in, you know, everyone's expression of response is different. You know, there's people whose response is to go to Kenya and dig wells, and the response of other people is to go into a classroom and hold the hand of the kid that's having the most trouble, you know, that's the bully. But we do have to respond. And the way we respond is what presents itself right in front of us in our lives, and it does, it keeps presenting itself. Because we're not separate from it, it'll keep presenting itself over and over and over again. And how we respond in this moment is what makes a difference. And, you know, we do the best we can, but we don't forget what we're doing for the sake of all beings.
It's more curiosity. I at the end of every coming together of our Sangha body, in Seattle, we dedicate the merit at the end of each evening. And I don't know why it came to me on this retreat, but we don't do it nightly here. And I wonder, I'm sure there's a good, you know, we do it at the end and we're holding the whole body for the whole week or whatever it is, but I'm just curious.
Have a special dedication ceremony at the end of this retreat, which is, those of you who've been at Indianola, we've done it before there, and there'll be slips on the bulletin board if you have somebody particularly you want to dedicate the merit of the retreat to. It's, you know, it's really to dedicate to somebody who's in an extreme situation, maybe recently died, or, you know, that's close to you and has a, you know, there's a real connection and it's personal. So you fill out the slip with your name, the person you're dedicating to, and your relationship to them, what their suffering is. Might be, you know, terminal cancer, you know, any number of things, but that are serious. And then what your wish is for them. So there's four things. First, the person you're dedicating to, your name and your relationship to that person, what they're suffering from, and what your wish is for them. And that'll be part of a special ceremony at the end where we offer the merit of what we've touched in this retreat for well-being in the world.
So I'll read another written question. The practice is so simple and so complex. As a new practitioner, where would you recommend I focus my attention beyond my breath and body? In other words, are there teachings that are a good place to start? With gratitude. I guess I would just begin by questioning why Do we need to focus our attention beyond our breath and body? I think that's enough already. That's enough for the rest of our lives. If we really focus our attention there, it's infinite. You know, what we can discover and learn. And the teachings that are a good place to start is everything we're doing here. We just continue, you know, just keep coming back to the present moment and being aware of what's happening in your body, in your mind. Sometimes I think we make things more complicated than they are. It's so simple, actually, that we think it's not, something's wrong with it. It's not, it can't be that simple. So we want to add more things. It must be more than just this. Because, let's be honest, it's also boring. I mean, over and over, just sitting, just breathing. Isn't there something else? Come on. Walking again. But that's it. It is just that simple, and it's hard. We struggle with that. That's just the mind, you know. I think it is important to find, you know, what are the things that bring us joy in the practice. Because that's what nourishes us and makes us want to continue. You know, it's not that we will always have joy, but as Eileen was saying, we each have our own unique way in the world. So we have our own way of practicing too. That's we have to hone and adjust and craft it, so that it fits for us. I mean, we have to be our own teacher too. Sister Chung Kong, Thay's assistant for the last 50 years, she said once, she was like, Thay is his Buddha, I'm my own Buddha. You know, like she's like, I'm not going to try to be like him. Yes, he's my teacher. Yes, I listen and follow, but I have to find my own path. And that's the same for all of us. So, you know, we learn the teaching, and then we have to be our inner coach, saying, "Oh, I think I need a little more walking, or I need, you know, to do something creative, you know, do some art or create a song, or you know, if we need to refresh our practice, we also need to know, okay, I'm getting in a rut, so let me bring in a new element or do what I'm used to doing with a different eye, so that I don't, you know, just take it for granted. I remember I decided one day to brush my teeth in a way I'd never brushed them before, just to make me wake up more to brushing my teeth. So instead of moving my hand, I kept my hand still and I moved my mouth. It was really fun. Not very effective, but and a group of sisters, we were traveling in England with Thay, and we had a sleepover and we read a story together, and then it was time to brush teeth, so we decided we're all going to brush each other's teeth. Very memorable. real interbeing experience. Anyway, just, you know, we want to know what is the basic foundation of the practice, and that is our breath and our steps, and being with our body. You know? And Thay says if we don't master that, don't do anything else, because what is it based on? If you try to study this or some, you know, think theoretical, or, you know, just stay with the basics. Everything is built on that, and just, you know, really get that in your bones. And it's, you know, it should really nourish us. So we want to always look at how we can keep it fresh. Thay's always sharing with us a new way to practice walking or sitting. Always. You know, I've been his student since 97, and he's always sharing some new way we can look at how to sit or walk. That's because he's discovering that for himself in his own practice. So, you know, we have the foundation, and then we want to keep it fresh. And Thay also says, you know, when people ask, how do I know if I'm doing walking meditation correctly? He says, if you enjoy it. So, we you know, our practice isn't hard labor. It's not. Sometimes it is sitting through difficult times and boredom and resistance. But it is also, you know, there are lots of fruits along the way that make us realize, yes, there are difficult times, but we know it works as we touch transformation, as we touch joy and relaxation, letting go. And just one last thing is I see it's really important too that we don't have an idea of what practice should be like. Like that after a certain number of years, I should be like this. Or, you know, I've been sitting now for an hour and my mind is still whatever, you know, like that we have some one-to-one. I put in this many hours, I get this result. You know, it's not like that. and I made myself suffer a lot at a certain point in my practice, thinking that I wasn't where I needed to be, that I should be experiencing something else, that there was like levels I was supposed to reach or attain. And I think what's really true is wherever we're at is where we're supposed to be. That there is no wrong experience that we can have. You know, it's all there for us to practice and to learn from. And I mean, for sure, I can say that the practice definitely leads to transformation. But it doesn't look like this. You know, I think it's like this. But it is moving. And, you know, but if we have an idea of what that should look like, how that should be, and have some striving of wanting to get enlightened and, you know, be, you know, free of anger and you know, at the end of this year, I will have no more greed, you know. I think those kind of things we always want to, you know, like the mindfulness trainings. That is the practice. Our breath, our body, our steps, the mindfulness trainings. Be happy in your sangha, you know. Cultivate relationships that nourish you in your family, in your work, you know. We were talking at the 5 mindfulness trainings panel about you become a Buddhist when you take the trainings or take the 3 refuges, and I wanted to share at that time. Somebody said this, I don't remember who, but don't be a Buddhist, be a Buddha. you know. So that is the practice, the basic practice. Manifest your Buddhahood, your acceptance, your compassion, your kindness, you know, as much as you can, wherever you go, with whoever you're with. The Dalai Lama says, be kind whenever possible. It's always possible. So, yeah, good luck.
I'm aware that we're almost at noon now and we probably won't get through all these questions. So, can we take this one up? Okay, you'll answer that?
Yeah.
Okay. So this one says, please talk about mountain lamp. How it came to be, what is the vision for this place? And the last section is, several monastics have spent time, practice, and teaching here. What is Sister Jewel's impression? So how did Mountain Lamp come to be? It's been a long, slow process. Mountain Lamp was conceived in about 1992 as a conceptual. And, you know, from there, you know, it was like the legal documents, getting a board. We tried to do it at the property. We lived it across this hill, other side of this hill, and couldn't do it. So we've had a couple of years sort of spinning our wheels there, and then another 3 or 4 years trying to find land that had the proper zoning that we could get the permits to do this. And so in 1997, we bought the first piece of property, which was up by the lake. And we had our first retreats were, this place had pretty much been destroyed, clear cut, and big huge gravel roads everywhere for logging trucks. And so our first job was planting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of trees. And so Sangha gathered every summer and replanted trees. And our first meditation hall was a tent that held 12 people, and it was out there by the circle in the grove where we sat on the rocks. And then this property that had buildings came available, and we sold our house on the other side, and with that money bought this piece of property. And some of you were here, I think, in the original house, which was so. And then the first year, the Sangha put up the yurt, and that became our new meditation hall. And we sat there until from 99 to 2008, which is when this was transformed into the meditation hall, and. There is adding on to the house, and pretty much every surface in the house, main house, has been redone. And then we added on to it, and then also remodeled the cottage most recently. So it's been just step by step, and lots of tender, loving care. And we are always so grateful when people are here and putting their energy into the property, because I think the property really carries that energy of practice and tender, loving care that all of you, I know, have contributed this week. The vision for the place is for it to be a place of practice for 500 years. And probably be a place of lay practice, support people who are living a lay life and want to go deep. And there's, you know, still lots of steps to go. I think our next step really is to have an organization that allows Mountain Lamp to really take over and own this property. That's what we're working on at this point, is organizational structure that really allows us to be the Sangha property, so that it continues past Jack and my life as a place of practice. And I think it has to be a kind of a new organizational vision, because all the organizational stuff we've looked at, you know, doesn't necessarily fit for the situation we're in. Other centers, you know, if you're in a city center, you know, there's lots of Sangha people right there all the time to help out and to, you know, be on boards and, you know, just to do the work, and as well as to practice deeply. But because we're kind of remote, relatively remote, you know, it's hard to, you know, we have people living here, but to have an organizational active organizational structure where people are from afar but also helping out, you know, move the vision forward is more challenging. We do have a wonderful board, and we have a board retreat coming up. Dale is one of our members who comes from afar to support Mountain Lamp over and over and over again. And are there any other board members here? I don't think so right now. But there are lots of people here who have been involved for many, many years and incredibly helpful in so many different ways of making Mountain Lamp be what it is now. And, you know, sometimes we say, well, you know, just what it is now is enough. And there's a lot more we can do. And both are true. Yeah, just being able to hold retreats like this, and inviting wonderful teachers like Sister Jewel to be with us, and to practice deeply together is enough. A retreat like this is enough. And I'm always so deeply grateful for people who come and teach, people who come and practice, and people who come and help out in whatever way they do, in the many ways they do. That's what Mountain Lamp is. Yeah, it's like you are Mountain Lamp.
So someone wanted to know my impressions of Mountain Lamp. Oh, wonderful. I have a deep respect for what has happened here, and all the work and commitment that Eileen and Jack and everyone who's lived here and who comes here to practice. It's a very solid practice energy, and it's very beautiful. I think it's my first time being I've been to Interzine. That's the other lay center that I've been to in Germany, in our tradition. These places are rare. And they're very, very precious. So I'm very grateful to have the chance to be here. I just feel like every time I go outside, I'm inspired by the beauty, by the sounds of the wild animals, and by the love of the domesticated animals, and by the smiles and the mindfulness of all of you. And I'm learning a lot being here. Also, just, you know, there are beautiful things that we don't do in our practice centers that are done here, like the bowl, putting the food in the bowl at lunch to offer to all beings. I find that very beautiful. And yeah, I'm very heartened and very inspired. And yeah, really, I feel at home here. So, I will be back.
Are there any really burning questions that are still?
I have a question, and you can answer now, but if you want. There's a lovely picture on the fireman's mantle in the kitchen. And there's this woman peering over Ty's shoulder, very sweet face, I live. And can you tell us, maybe may know the story behind that picture, but I would love to hear it if you have good time.
That picture was taken at a retreat at Kokoan Zendo with Thay and Aitken Roshi in 1985. And it was Thay's second teaching tour in the United States. And he was here in the 60s talking about the war, but then he didn't come back until 1982, when he was invited to speak at a council of churches. And after that, he was invited to come and begin teaching. And in 1983, he came and did his first teaching tour, which was when I first met him. And he was at San Francisco Zen Center and ZCLA, and just sort of went to a number of different Zen centers around. And in 1984, there was a gathering for engaged Buddhism in Holland, and Aitken Roshi, my husband and I, Jack and I, were currently at that point living in Kokoan Zendo. We'd left our house here with caretakers and moved to Honolulu to study with Aitken Roshi. And Aitken Roshi went over to this conference and met Thay, and they both were immediately attracted to each other and struck up a friendship, and Thay invited Aitken and his wife Anne to come down to Plum Village, and so they went down to Plum Village and then invited Thay to come lead a retreat at Kokoan. And so that retreat was I think 85, and it was a fairly small retreat. I mean, the retreats, I think there were 35 people at that retreat. And so I got to spend quite a bit of time with Thay. I was the temple keeper and doing what Van and Lupita are doing here. But because I was organizing that retreat, I spent a lot of time with Thay and was very, very touched. I felt I'd found my heart connection. And so it was a wonderful retreat. And so the picture has Anne and Roshi in the front sitting next to Thay, and that's Chung Kong sitting next to there with long hair before she was Chi Feng. She was Chi Feng then. And That's kind of the story of that picture. So it seems like, you know, just out of, you know, how the universe works, that it represents something that's happening here at Mountain Lamp. I continued to study with Aitken Roshi up until his death. But Thay was my root teacher, and that was always became very clear to me. I actually met Thay before I met Aitken, and it was always clear for Jack that Aitken Roshi was his root teacher. And somehow that picture represents, you know, our lineages and the lineages that we try to support here at Mountain Lamp, the Diamond Sangha lineage of Aitken Roshi and the Plum Village lineage of Thich Nhat Hanh. And try to keep the practices kind of pure, but they you know, there's definitely some, they inform each other here. and on rare occasion, Jack and I teach together, which we do a 3-week study retreat every May where we both teach. And that's probably the most mixing of the two traditions. And other than that, we try to keep them kind of as true to their roots, true to our root teachers, who our debt of gratitude can never be repaid. Thank you for excellent questions. Wow.